Well, first of all, actually, if you do want to ask any questions, just feel free, go ahead. But you better sort of gesture at me in some way. Well, politely, that is. I did put handouts from the copies of the PowerPoint slides on the table, so I hope everybody got that. But if there's any spare, could you sort of pass them around? Thank you. Well, what I'm going to try and do today is ignore the Vikings on TV series, where they have clearly done their research and then completely ignored it. What I'm going to try and talk about actually is the image of the Viking and where we get, and where indeed that TV series gets its idea about the stereotypical Viking. And it's quite an interesting story. Without a doubt, the poem that I'm going to be dealing with later on in this talk is called, it's probably the best known Viking poem, certainly the most influential, and it's called The Death Song of Ragnar Lothbrok. Well, I thought I'd start by setting a bit of context. And first of all, what did the Vikings believe in? And if we can understand that, maybe we can understand more about the way in which they acted. That didn't work. Thank you. All right. I'm going to do a brief synopsis of Norse mythology. The thing about Norse mythology, of course, that's different from Christian culture is that it's polytheistic. There are many gods. And you couldn't really say that in Norse mythology that there are any absolute notions of good or evil. In fact, the Norse gods are a treacherous, lying bunch for the main part. However, they have a purpose. Now, I'll just take you through from creation to Ragnarok, the doom of the gods. This slide here, showing this creature, this human-like creature suckling on a cow, that creature is called Ymir, and he's the prime giant. And him and the cow were created by a confusion of ice coming down from the north and fire coming up from the south, and there these two creatures are produced. Well, Ymir spawns from himself a load of giants, a great army of giants. And also, curiously, from his left armpit, the first man and woman, the sort of Adam and Eve of Norse mythology, but already fallen. Eventually, a thaw sets in, and the cow is licking the ice, and from the ice there emerges a gigantic human-like creature. And in due course, this creature's descendants kills Ymir and fashions his body into the Norse cosmos. So Ymir is quite clearly wicked, destructive, deeply unpleasant, anti-life in many ways. And as a consequence, the Norse cosmos is then in itself materially evil, we might say it, inappropriately perhaps. Okay, so this is the Norse cosmos, and you can see there are three planes in it. At the very top, there is the tree Yggdrasil, which translates roughly as Odin's horse, for he crucifies himself on it for 9 days in order to receive wisdom. In that top tier, there is Asgard, the home of the gods, and Valhalla, significantly. I'll say there's something about Valhalla again in a minute. Now, you can see there's a rainbow bridge connects Asgard to what is in effect Middle-earth, or Midgard. And that Midgard is the home of human beings, but is also the home of those creatures most hostile to the gods and humans, the giants. Bifrost, the rainbow bridge, is protected by the god Heimdall, and really, he's on the lookout for an attack from the giants. In the lower tier is Hel. And you can probably just see it there right at the bottom, the fearsome dragon Nidhogg, which is the ultimate apocalyptic dragon. Back to Midgard. Surrounding Midgard is another huge dragon-like monster known as the Midgard Serpent, or Jormungandr. Jormungandr, Nidhogg, and other apocalyptic creatures will all come against the gods at Ragnarok. Significantly, actually, in terms of the fate and destiny of mankind, are the Norns. And they live at the bottom of that tree in the Well of Urd. They're three female figures, and they determine everybody's fate, including that of the gods to a certain extent. They know everything. So again, quite unusual compared to Christian belief, insofar we have these extraordinarily powerful women. Well, actually, extraordinarily powerful, but also not very pleasant, for the fates they typically determine are doom and chaos. The three chief gods then. Freya, the fertility goddess, who is constantly under threat by the giants and actually would be being abducted by them were it not for Thor, who we see here on the right-hand side. Thor is the son of Odin, who we see in the middle there, and Thor's job... Thor is not really very bright, but he is the ultimate machismo. He represents everything a warrior should represent, and his main job is to kill giants and trolls. Odin, on the other hand, who is a cunning politician, so read what you like into that, he's a cunning politician, and he has got one main job, and that is to collect heroes, fallen heroes, from the battlefield and bring them here to Valhalla. And it is at Valhalla where the fallen heroes will be training every day for Ragnarok. In other words, they fight each other all day, then they go and get drunk every night. Sounds all right, actually, but that's what they do. And transporting them to Valhalla under Odin's instructions are the Valkyries. Again, female powerful figures. Well, the one god that is significant, really significant beyond these, is the god Loki. Loki starts off by being sort of mischievous, but as this mythological cycle progresses, he becomes increasingly malevolent. He's the nearest we've got to a Satan figure in Norse mythology. The most perfect of the gods is called Balder. Hi. He's called Balder, Balder is invulnerable to all things except one thing, and that is mistletoe. Well, as a consequence of him being invulnerable, it's the practice of the gods to get him to stand there while they hurl things at him, spears, arrows, rocks, anything, because he can't be hurt. Well, Loki decides he's going to join in, but he has an arrow made of mistletoe. And this he gives to the one god who can't participate normally, to Hod, who is blind. So he gives him the bow and arrow with the mistletoe arrow, and Hod kills Balder. Well, the punishment of Loki then is to be bound on a rock for all time, though it doesn't last that long actually, he has a snake over him dripping venom onto his face, and his wife, Sif, is supposed to hold a carton underneath it to try and catch the venom. But why didn't she get a bigger carton? Because every now and again, she has to go away and empty it out, at which point the venom drips on Loki's face, and he writhes in agony, which is the origin of earthquakes. So, thence comes, the ultimate doom of the gods, and this is it here. And you can just sort of vaguely see the Midgard serpent here confronting Thor, which is mutually assured destruction, and same here, the apocalyptic wolf Fenrir confronting Odin, and indeed swallowing him. We do know, however, that at the end of the mythological cycle, according to certain Norse poems, actually some gods survive, and some new gods emerge. And it's as if the whole cycle is repeating itself. At first, it's beautiful, paradisical indeed, but then, actually, that dragon comes flying in the sky, bearing corpses. So we then know that the whole miserable, fated scenario is happening again, presumably ad infinitum. Well, given this violent world, given this kind of the treacherous, difficult, violent, and altogether doom-laden world, how would one behave with those beliefs. Next, please. Thanks. Well, the Viking heroic code. I'll show off and recite this in Old Norse to begin with, then I'll translate. Deir fei, deir freindre, deir sjálfr it sama, en orthir, deir aldregi, veim esse guðan getra. Cattle die, kinsmen die, even oneself will die, but that which never dies is the good reputation one wins to oneself. The only transcendent consolation for a living human being is fame, good reputation. And what does a good reputation mean? Well, it means that actually you don't own yourself. The whole idea of who you are is possessed by those around you. So you've constantly got to live up to expectations of others of whatever you do. And this creates a sort of do or die mentality in the Vikings. Next, please. Right, just a bit of context now on the history of the Viking Age leading up to the legend of Ragnar. Well, 8th of June, 793, the attack on Lindisfarne, Holy Island. And it is generally referred to by many critics as the Pearl Harbor of the Dark Ages. Totally unexpected, totally out of the blue. There may have been some piratical raids before that, but nothing like this. And, of course, here we see fiery dragons were seen flying in the air, says the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. Holy Island, they couldn't have picked a more sacred spot, actually. This is the home of Cuthbert, St. Aidan, and so on, and the Lindisfarne Gospels, etc. So this shook Christendom to the core. Next, please. This is Alcuin of York writing at the time of the Lindisfarne attack, just afterwards. And this is what he says. We and our fathers have now lived in this land for nearly 350 years, and never before has such an atrocity been seen in Britain as we have suffered at the hands of a pagan people. Our holiest of places spattered with blood. Such a voyage was not thought possible. Kind of curious, that last sentence, actually, because Scandinavian traders had been coming over for decades, actually. So much so, they'd even actually created a hair fashion style that the Anglo-Saxons imitated. So why this attack? Well, possibly they saw that England was weak, too comfy, too cozy. We know from the evidence of archaeology that actually, over that 350 years referred to there, the Anglo-Saxons got smaller. Life got easier. They were farmers. The occasional war between a couple of principalities and so on and so forth. But generally speaking, it was easy. There were no coastal defences to speak of. Thank you. And the Viking expansion, as you know, was considerable. There they are, coming to Norway, Sweden, but actually going across the north there, discovering Iceland and settling there, discovering Greenland and settling there, and actually discovering North America in the year 1000 and settling briefly there. Elsewhere, down through into old Byzantium, as far as Baghdad, though they weren't stupid enough to try and stay there. And on through into the Mediterranean, and this carnage here down through Germany and France. This is pretty extraordinary stuff. I mean, they had remarkable navigation skills, of course, but actually, nobody'd undertaken an expansion like this ever before. Next, please. Well, after 793, the Vikings set to raiding regularly. Unfortunately, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle doesn't tell us much about these raids. Occasionally ones are mentioned if there's holy places involved, but otherwise it doesn't say anything. For the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle was really spawned in Wessex. It's a southern thing, so I'm not terribly interested in what happens in the north until this. And this is the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle for the year 866, the conquest of York. In this year went this Danish army from East Anglia across Humber Mouth to York in Northumbria, and there was great strife in that people between themselves. And they had thrown out their king, Osbert, and had taken a low-born king, Ella. And it was late in the year that the two kings agreed on this, that they should fight back against the Danish army. and they gathered a great army and sought out the Danish army at York and attacked the city, and some of them got inside. And there was untold slaughter done upon the Northumbrians there, some inside, some outside. And the kings were both slain, and the survivors made peace with the Danish army. Now, beyond that, actually, we don't know for certain, not from any English sources anyway, why this suddenly happened, why it suddenly went. There was a paradigm shift from raiding and piracy and plunder and that sort of thing to suddenly a vast army arriving in York. Can we see the next one? You can see the consequences of that, the heathen army arriving in 865, taking York in 866. But you can see, actually, the York Vikings then spread right down through the country, into the West Country, right down through the South, and so on, over the next 12, 15 years. This was an attempt to conquer the whole of England. The legacy, which we're going to see with us today, in the place names. Any place names ending in BY or Thorpe are Viking settlements. But even if they're ending in Tun, often they actually have a Viking forename before it, and we call these Grimston hybrids. In other words, they've just taken over an Anglo-Saxon settlement and imposed their name on the first element of the settlement. And you can see Lincolnshire, heavily populated down through into the Midlands, there right across up through North Yorkshire and on into Cumbria, the main settlement areas. Thanks. Well, that's so much as we know. We know what happened. We know what the consequences were, but actually we don't know why. Now, of course, you could simply say, well, actually, they saw an opportunity and they took it. However, Scandinavian sources think there was another reason, much more personal. And the two main sources that I've used to compile this talk actually are The History of the Danes by Saxo Grammaticus, and that's 12th century, and the Ragnar's Saga, 13th century. Now, actually, we do have other sources which corroborate some of this stuff, but, of course, you'd have to say, well, this is hundreds of years after the event. How true is it going to be? Some of it is true. We can find corroboration of it. But the story of Ragnar is going to be important. And I'm going to deal, firstly, with Ragnar's love life, which is as checkered as his Viking career. His first wife, which I believe is actually in the TV series, isn't it? But as Lagertha, I think, yeah. But it's Lathgertha. And Lathgertha is a shield maiden, that extraordinary woman that was as courageous and as ferocious as any male warrior. Well, Ragnar spots her in the distance. He sees what she's capable of doing, and he decides to court her. Lathgertha is a little bit encouraging at first. She's vaguely flattered by it, but she also plays hard to get. Eventually, she does give in, and they sort of marry, but it doesn't last long. Lathgertha is rather indifferent to Ragnar's amorous behaviour, shall we say, consequently, they decide to call it a day and go their own ways. Now, Lathgertha is very interesting, actually, because it may be that she is actually a confusion with a Swedish goddess called Thorgerth. And here we see Thorgerth. And Thorgerth actually comes from a place from Lathge. So that's quite possible that they are one and the same character somewhere back in myth and legend. Well, more on that in a minute. Next, please. Thank you. After Lathgertha, Ragnar comes across another maiden. Now, this maiden, Thora, her father, as a present, when she was just a young kid, gives her a little snake in a little box, and she lives in this bower house here. However, this little snake gets bigger and bigger and bigger until it surrounds the entire bower. Thora cannot get out and nobody can get in. Ragnar hears about this and he and his shipmates arrive near the scene. Now, he gets off the ship and he has a great coat which he smears in oil and then covers in sand. And this great cape and his trousers, same, actually is where he gets his name, according to this legend, as Hairy Breeches. And what the hairy breeches actually do is make him impervious to flame. So he goes and attacks the dragon, and he duly kills it. And as a consequence, Thora's father gives her to him to be his bride. Now, where I'm quite happy to debate just about every possibility of historical difficulty in Ragnar, and believe me, scholars do in Ragnar's saga, but actually, this one, I do not believe that there is any truth in it. And that's not simply because there's a dragon involved, of course. Well, you'd say, well, it's not true, there's a dragon involved. But they believed in dragons, so fair enough. However, this particular story, the hero winning a bride as a consequence of killing a dragon, well, we know that story. It's Perseus and Andromeda from about 600 BC. Now, actually, as I say, there is no other version of a hero killing a dragon, winning a bride anywhere in Icelandic sagas or Norse mythology. And actually, if you think about it, in some ways it doesn't quite fit with the mentality. This transference from the father to the suitor. And if you think about it, actually, of course, this would fit well with Greek mythology because it was precisely that patriarchal structure that we recognize as part of our own history. And really, what killing a dragon to win the bride is really just actually the good suitor beating the bad suitor being the dragon, and then the bride being transferred as a commodity, as property, from the father to the good suitor. I don't believe this one. I believe that this is an inserted legend, and I note that it is not in Saxo. So it's in Ragnar's saga, though. Thank you.